Chuck Ellis recently tweeted, and I quote, "Dear past self, why didn't you download the NPR One app sooner? Don't deprive yourself of audio bliss. Also, don't eat that cheeseburger," end quote. Thank you, Chuck, and you're right. NPR One is ready to make your commute, standing in line, or waiting for a cheeseburger better. Find NPR One in your app store, and now you can ask Alexa to play NPR One.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we'll drop in on the volatile suburban surroundings of HBO's Big Little Lies, and we'll consider Ryan Murphy's high-drama look at Hollywood legends in Feud. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. But before we get started here in historic Studio 45 this week, let's go around the table.
I'm Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write for the NPR website.
And with us this week in our fourth chair is one of our dearest friends, Weekend Edition editor Barry Hardiman. Hi, Barry.
Hi.
One of the most impressive casts to hit premium cable in a while is the one featured in Big Little Lies, HBO's new drama about the dark underbelly of a suburban circle of wealthy moms. Based on a novel by Leon Moriarty, the show was created and written by David E. Kelly, who made prestige television on broadcast before prestige television even existed. And all the episodes are directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, who directed Wild and Dallas Buyers Club. That impressive cast I mentioned includes Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, Shailene Woodley, Laura Dern, Zoe Kravitz, Adam Scott, and others. Barry, I think, is the person who came into this maybe the most excited about digging into this world of moms.
Well, yes, and partly because I know this is, I'm no spoilers, because the way that the series is told is very much the way the book is,
right,
is told. But I really, really loved the book.
Yeah.
And I really like Moriarty in general. I mm-hmm. think she does this kind of the domestic mystery really, really well.
Yeah. And I think we can say, without it being too mm-hmm. much of a spoiler, because it's kind of the opening of the book, that you know you're dealing with the aftermath of a murder.
Right.
But they don't say who it is,
right,
or what has happened.
Right.
And that's kind of, and then it's all flashbacks.
Yeah. I'm two episodes in, and I couldn't spoil this if I tried. Yeah.
Right.
I have seen a little bit more than you have, and Barry has read the book. Mm-hmm. And because they didn't give me the last episode, I had to go read the Wikipedia entry.
Oh, you had to do it.
Uh-huh.
Because I was dying of suspense, which is probably a good sign. What did you think, Glenn?
I wasn't dying of suspense. I mean, I wasn't necessarily hankering for another Dark Secrets of Suburbia thing. And what I do like about this is that this story is given, these characters anyway, are given room to breathe. That's good and bad,
mm-hmm.
because they're doling out the mystery stuff so parsimoniously mm-hmm. that I have already lost interest. Don't care about the mystery.
Oh, interesting.
But,
interesting.
I mean, these women are introduced as types, as desperate housewives, but instead of getting soapy plot developments, because they're not spending a lot of time on plot, we get, over and over again, character beats.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Reese Witherspoon's character starts off as Tracy Flick, but she's allowed to deepen. We revisit her over and over again. For example, the dynamic between her and her daughter starts off, their interactions at the kitchen table are so rote and predictable.
It's kind of her teenage daughter.
Her young daughter, a surly teenage daughter.
Uh-huh.
That's the TV default. But then I think it's in the second episode, we get a scene between them which totally undercuts that very reflexive, boring, generic relationship. And we get a different side. But then, importantly, I think, it reverts back to that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the way human beings are, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
That you can have a breakthrough moment, but people need a really big push to change.
Yeah.
And that's what I really liked about this. We're getting room, so I'm more interested in the characters than in the plot.
Yeah, interesting. How about you, Stephen?
I'm almost a little bit the inverse of that. My sense on this, having watched a few episodes, I mean, I'm here for a prestige soap opera, right? You know, I mean, this is like prestige the show.
You are here for a kitchen island.
I mean, Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman. I mean, remember when like movie stars wouldn't do TV?
Totally.
Yeah. But I found over time, the murder stuff, as you said, is doled out so parsimoniously. I'm kind of like, get to the fireworks factory. I kind of want to know what show I'm watching a little bit. I kind of had this sense, like almost like Riverdale, where it's like, I'm not going to keep watching, but I'm kind of curious who did it.
Right. Yeah.
Or what happened.
Or what happened.
Right. Right. Yeah. So the thing about the mystery coming out so slowly is that it is little, but it's almost, instead of like a little raindrop, it's like a mist. So you're surrounded right. by it in this way. Mm-hmm. That in the book, it is much more, how do I say this without making it sound not fun? It doesn't have that sense of like, of atmosphere as much as it's dangling the fact that you don't know
right.
what
right.
happened. And right. I actually, one thing that I really like actually about the miniseries versus the book is that it is more character than it is this mystery. The overhang of the mystery of the book is really, because that's kind of what she does. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that because the book is set in Australia, in a beachy peninsula that I know nothing about in Sydney, I didn't come to it with any knowledge, whereas I know something, I mean, we all do, about this world of Monterey and these particular moms mm-hmm. and these, you know, this sort of Tory Burch kitchen island. Oh my God, seriously, that kitchen?
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
I almost drew a full floor plan. I
could
die.
All of the houses are beautiful. What I like about it, and I wound up really liking it, and what I really like about it is I think that the mystery stuff is getting doled out very slowly in terms of concrete clues. But I think that everything that you will eventually need to understand mm-hmm. what happened requires you to have an understanding of a lot more things than just the TikTok of what happened on the night of this, right? And I think one of the things that is a kind of what I would consider to be an unconventional kind of mystery is, what is the nature of particularly the Nicole Kidman marriage?
Right.
Because her husband is played by Alexander Skarsgård, and the two of them have this relationship that is played with a lot of ambiguity.
Yes.
There's a lot of anger in it. There's a lot of kind of violence in it that is sort of mixed together with their sex life. And it is unclear in the TV series how exactly that functions and how functional or dysfunctional it is for them. And I think that that's the kind of thing where it's not a conventional mystery, but over the course of the episodes, there is an arc. Mm-hmm. Where you sort of learn more about it and you come to understand it, and it's related to kind of this more conventional mystery of what happened that night. Mm-hmm. And I think they do a good job of mixing together those dramas with a kind of a more bubbly kind yeah. of, you know, cop is sitting there questioning a bunch of people, and it's kind of a montage of different character right. actors, including, mm-hmm. for example, Sarah Baker, who's
yes.
been on Louie, mm-hmm. who's wonderful.
It's great on Louie.
Kind of saying different sort of bitchy things about mm-hmm. these people. The thing I like about the fact that it's a murder mystery is what this show isn't is just a lot of navel-gazing about suburbia.
Mm-hmm. True.
There are other things going on in this story besides just, you know, underneath the
affluence
right, of yeah. suburbia. It's not American Beauty.
Right.
It's not mostly about that, even though it's that portrait. It really is this underlying story about these specific people who have pasts and things about them.
Well, and one thing it has in common with like a very character-filled drama like This Is Us is you can get invested way more in one person's story than in another person's
mm-hmm.
story.
And yeah.
and like, I was less invested in that kind of David E. Kelly-ism of like kids saying ridiculously precocious things
mm-hmm. sure.
than I was in the Adam Scott character.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was lovely. Yeah.
I just found it to mm-hmm. be immediately a very rich and interesting and layered portrayal in a way that I think kind of pivots off of like his nice guy.
His comedy thing, yeah.
His
sure.
nice guy. A comedy thing in like Parks and Rec really gets a twist that goes beyond his beard.
Yeah, and Adam Scott plays the husband of the Reese Witherspoon character, a nice guy.
And her second husband.
Her mm-hmm. second husband, right. And he gets a speech in the second episode, which really resonated with me
yeah.
for a variety of reasons that I'm not going to spoil. But what was lacking for me until a certain point in the second episode was anything that was surprising. Mm. I don't want to say like a water cooler moment, but something like that would cause you to say, oh, you really have to see this,
mm-hmm.
right? Because the characters are well-rounded is not a thing that kind of go, oh, God. I mean, you could,
right.
but it needed something a little more specific, sharper. And finally, mm-hmm. near the end of the second episode, we get this exchange.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I don't know what's wrong with this woman. It's like she's power hungry. She can't just let us all get along.
I said thank you!
That's Laura Dern being very, very uptight and then kind of letting all that uptightness out.
I had to rewind and watch that.
It was so much fun.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that Stephen mentioned David E. Kelly, who made Ally McBeal and The Practice and
Pick Fences.
And a lot of kind of, as I said in the intro, what prestige television kind of was before prestige television on premium cable. And where I see David E. Kelly in this is in this kind of stylized dialogue and the way I think he's always been good at kind of interesting conversations between people. But I also would mention the direction by Vallée. There is a lot of really interesting use of, and it may not be him, but also the editing, I think, is very good. The music choices are really interesting.
Yeah.
Whoever is kind of assembling the musical palette of this show, I think, has a real feel for a combination of kind of nostalgic music and current music. And there's a lot of sudden cutting. There are some really nice uses of silence, particularly later in the series. It is creatively shot, edited, set up, composed, as opposed to being just kind of, you know, done like an ordinary piece of television.
But where I see the Kelly as well, the kinds of humor in the way that we just said that kind of resonate in that kind of Ally McBeal bathroom kind of way, in some of the amazing swear words or expressions that Reese Witherspoon uses, there's a real kind of lightness to it, to what is will turn out to be a really kind of terrifying story. And I really, that gives, because the editing is so crazy at some points that it can be kind of overwhelming, those bits of humor are really light. And, you know, and as far as I'm concerned, Reese Witherspoon is worth the price of this ticket. I mean, she, whenever she's on the screen, I can't take my eyes off her. I found her interchanges with the daughter really, like, far more moving than I did in the book, and just far more moving than I thought I would. And I don't, it's like Tracy Flick without the satire, but, you know, and she appears to be watching the same thing we are, with exactly the same eye of, like, I know this is ridiculous,
right.
I think they
do a good job of making her, she's a type, but she's not a cartoon.
No, exactly.
And there is some very genuine ambivalence in the way that the show feels about her. She is kind of that rich mom who wants everything perfect, competitive.
But knows it.
She knows it, and there is a genuine
charm.
Sort of charm to her, and a basic desire to do well. And I think one of the things that they try to stay with these moms is that as imperfectly as they're doing it, I think they leave all of these mothers in the place where they're all trying to do the right thing for their kids.
Right.
And even though they are types, you know, you don't get the kind of the scenes where they're saying, oh, go play out there. Mommy doesn't want you to get your feet on the couch.
Right.
It's not a picture of
caricature,
cold, bad mothers. It's a picture of loving parents who have obviously a lot going on socially that's perhaps not that great. I will be curious to hear what those of you who have seen the first episode or two of Big Little Lies think about it. It's on HBO. As we tape this, there are a couple episodes in. And so come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH and tell us what you think of Big Little Lies. And when we come back, we are going to talk about Feud, the Ryan Murphy melodramatic, to say the least, miniseries about Bette Davis and Joan Crawford. So come right back.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/happyhour.
We've never asked you to do anything quite like this, but right now, we want you to think of someone you care about and ask yourself, what podcast would they really love? We're asking you to actually reach out to them and tell them. We're hoping you'll spread the word, not just about any particular podcast, but about podcasting in general. If they don't know how to listen, show them how. Then tell us what you recommended using the hashtag TryPod. That's TryPod. and thank you for spreading the word.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now, FX has run a lot of material from Glee co-creator Ryan Murphy in recent years, including American Horror Story and American Crime Story. But now he's got a new anthology series called Feud, and the first round focuses on the legendary Hollywood rivalry of Joan Crawford and Bette Davis, which, according to legend, came to a head when the two filmed Whatever Happened to Baby Jane together. It was released in 1962. Ryan Murphy regular Jessica Lange plays Crawford, Susan Sarandon plays Bette Davis, and supporting and cameo roles abound for everyone from Catherine Zeta-Jones to Kathy Bates. And we should also mention that just as we tape this, we learned today that the second season of Feud, which will come next year, is going to be about Charles and Diana, which, mercy, that should be dark.
And rich.
And this is pretty dark, too. So Feud has a total of 8 episodes. I've seen 5. And I want to note off the top that at least one film historian, whose name is Farron Smith Neme, did an interview with Inku Kang at MTV News and has sort of said, it's important to take some of this with a lot of this with a grain of salt in terms of its historic accuracy. Mm. This is kind of the legend version of this story, but there is a lot of doubt about, you know, how much of that is catfight liking and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to misrepresent it as a documentary when it is not one. Glenn, tell me where you are, where you kind of orient to Feud.
Okay. I will confess a passing familiarity with the subject matter, inasmuch as I am a queer dude of middle age with a pulse. Baby Jane, it's in the packet they hand you on gay orientation day.
Anti-mame.
It's anti-mame. Right. It's all about Eve.
Right.
It's the women. It's a fiercely held opinions about the place of boom, 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 let's go back to my room in the Great American Songbook. I know this legend. I know this film. I know these characters. But I also know Ryan Murphy. And that didn't lead me to have very high hopes, because there are two Ryan Murphys, I think. The one that of Nip Tuck and American Horror Story, Scream Queens, and to a lesser extent, Glee, it just doesn't work for me. Starts out working for me, mm-hmm. but then inevitably goes off the rails, because I think that Ryan Murphy conflates tone with structure. Thinks that you can just exchange one for the other.
Explain that a little
more. Okay, so archness, whatever you want to call it, campiness, the way he approaches those four properties doesn't carry you very far, cannot be sustained. Mm-hmm. You need an actual story. Collapses. Mm-hmm. We talked about how Riverdale needs to lean into its weirdness more. He has a habit of leaning so far into his weirdness that he falls face first into it and just wallows in it. And
things comes just, out with a face full of lipstick.
Just exactly. Things just fall apart. The two times it hasn't happened with him are American Crime Story, People versus O.J. Simpson, and here. Because he's not making up the story. Mm-hmm. The story is handed to him.
Right.
And
right.
he's doing something with it. I think the reason that this Feud works even better in my mind than People versus O.J. Simpson is because that archness, that campiness is the subject matter.
Yeah.
He has a familiarity with that.
Yeah.
And he's telling you a story about that.
And he cares about it deeply. I said to somebody today on Twitter, I have a feeling if Ryan Murphy ever had a spinal tap, this show is what would come out in his spinal fluid.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's my question. When you heard about this project and the two actresses who were involved, did you think they were going to be the parts that they were playing? Because I had it exactly in my head switched.
Oh, did you?
No, never.
No, Susan Sarandon looks so much like Bette Davis.
She's almost a ringer for it. Yeah, she has the same, she's got the eye thing.
She has the Bette Davis eyes. I agree.
Interesting.
That's very interesting. Why did you think that?
I saw Jessica Lange in the Bette Davis role.
Yeah.
Just because she's bigger, you know?
And if you're not familiar with Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, I think the short version is...
Good
luck.
This movie really assumes you are.
Yes.
I mean, it actually assumes you are.
I'm strapping in to hear you explain to me what Happened to Baby Jane is
Whatever
about.
Happened to mm-hmm. Baby Jane is about aging sisters, one of whom uses a wheelchair and the other of whom is a very kind of clownishly dressed former child star who takes care of her after a fashion. And they have a very, there's a lot of negativity between
she
them.
She takes care of her the same way that Kathy Bates takes care of
James Caan.
In
James
Misery. Right, exactly. Is responsible for
right,
her,
exactly,
I'll say.
For and, her paraplegic sister.
Much happens in terms of their relationship. It is fundamentally a horror movie. According to this,
right,
you know, they refer to it a bunch of times as a horror movie in Feud. I don't know that I would have necessarily thought of it as a horror movie, but it's definitely a scary movie.
On the continuum, it's at the early end of the genre, but it's,
right.
I think it's horror.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. So, Barry.
Yes.
Orient me to you and Feud. You seemed so excited
I
to talk about
I have
this.
Almost never been more excited for a thing to appear on television. When I thought that somebody was making a joke, when I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, someone just sort of is making, like, that's just, no one's going to really
it's just
do that.
Barry's dream
it's just
project.
My dream.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's Ryan Murphy. I mean, it is so exactly a thing that I wanted. What's interesting, though, and by the way, I am enjoying this with the fierceness of all the off-the-shoulder dresses one can wear on a staircase. But I will say that in this case, he's leaning into camp, I think, at the expense, for me, of context. And so I have, about two episodes in, I sort of resigned myself that we were going to have the camp version of this thing. And we weren't going to get, actually, the People versus O.J. Simpson with a lot of context. You know, I mean, if you didn't know that Hollywood was run by men and that women were encouraged to catfight, and this, it's hardly a surprise. I think that because he's leaning his, you know, the eyebrows so far arched, I think he is actually trafficking in all of the stereotypes that led to the feud, foe, or no.
And with which he has some history.
Oh, sure. For sure.
His treatment of older women. And sad
and
women
I wish
and all that
you know
stuff.
And maybe this is a moment to I don't know if we've talked about the You Must Remember This podcast mm-hmm. before on this show. She does Joan Crawford in six parts, and I wish that some of the there had been a little more theory about the kinds of women these two different stars were, and he's assuming a familiarity with the studio system, with from silent to talkies, with the kind of actress that Joan Crawford was, which she was a sex symbol.
Right.
Betty Davis was like never a sex symbol because she just wasn't that. She was working against that. And so, you know, that
was more of a theater, perceived as more of a theater.
So there, you know, I mean, one of her famous lines, which I'm going to get wrong, unfortunately, is she says something like, you know, sure, Joan Crawford is a movie star, but I'm, you know, I'm an actress, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's some, and so that relationship, which you see a little of, I think could have been mined for something, you know, more women writers could have mined in a more interesting way. But I also, one more thing I just have to say, could you not have died for every Easter egg of Olivia de Havilland? And Joan Blondell.
Right.
And oh my God, when they go to the Oscars, I'm just going to spoil it for
right.
you. The camera pans. It's everybody. It's Gregory Peck. I can't even. I'm going to say
So here's the other.
Make it to episode 5 is all I'm saying.
Here's the other piece.
Barry is now
we...
lying down in her chair.
Yep.
Here's the other piece that we
Not
kind of have to explain. Here's the piece that we kind of have to explain. So the story is set in the very early 1960s mm-hmm. because the movie is going to come out in 62. Murphy's framing device is interviews that take place in 1978 with Olivia de Havilland and Joan Blondell, played by Catherine Zeta-Jones and Kathy Bates, who are essentially, again, in the late 70s, so they are older, mm-hmm. they are older actresses, mm-hmm. already kind of telling nostalgia stories about how it was. There's a lot of kind of there at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, and they're kind of doing the Hollywood Stars Talk About Old Hollywood mm-hmm. documentary style interview, and that's the framing device for the show. And I wonder why that was the decision about how to frame the
show. I have
show.
Thoughts on this, but I'm concerned that we haven't heard from the straight guy yet. So,
yeah.
You know, at long last, my people can be heard.
Hit it, Thompson.
I mean, first of all, I think those are there in part to provide massive amounts of exposition and make it go down more easily because it's these two actresses that you like.
Yeah.
I thought this show, just the more I watched it, the more I just kept thinking, this was such a good idea. Like, this was such a good idea for a TV show. The casting mm-hmm. of Susan Sarandon and Jessica Lange, who already have iconic faces. So when you watch them play people who also had iconic mm-hmm. faces. They don't have to be the exact same faces.
Yeah.
You are seeing the faces mm-hmm. of movie icons. Mm-hmm. It sells what they're doing that much more. It is a conflict and drama-filled story about conflict and drama-filled people. Mm-hmm. It just lends itself so much to such big, chewy, exciting conflict. I don't think that this show is flawless. I'm not really on board with what Stanley Tucci's doing as Jack Warner.
Interesting.
Oh, I love Stanley Tucci. He's my, yeah, no, that's interesting.
That is interesting, because I think he's, I was thinking during this of like how reliably I always love watching
him. I love him. I'm a fan of him as an actor. This,
not this.
This portrayal is so broad. I mean, obviously, there's a portrayal that's too broad on Few.
I know. It's broads all over the place.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry, I had to.
And it
was in my packet.
And of course, you also have all these opportunities to comment on what kind of created a lot of the conflict between these people, which I found historically interesting. I haven't seen Whatever Happened to Baby Jane since I was, I think, 15. It was one of those movies that my parents like sat me mm-hmm. down and made me
sure.
watch. I was pretty all in pretty quickly on this one.
Yeah.
You know, I think the presence of the Joan Blondell character and the Olivia de Havilland character are a faint toward providing some of what you were missing, Barry, which is that context.
Because you get the Joan Fontaine reference. And,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
But here's the thing. I mean, this thing is filled with huge clots of expository
yes.
dialogue. Mm-hmm. Characters declaiming exactly what's on their mind mm-hmm. at that present time. Mm-hmm. Characters explaining and re-explaining historical events. The mm-hmm. worst offender here is the Judy Davis Hedda Hopper character, mm-hmm. who over and over again is given the line, "Oh, come on now, Joan, you know very well that," and then that Joan knows very well.
She's got, by the way, great hats.
She's got great hats.
If you and if you've never seen them, Google image Hedda Hopper's hats.
Yeah.
So I came to a terrifying realization because of this, that you put the clunkiest dialogue in the mouth of seasoned mm-hmm. mother effing pros, mm-hmm. and it just dissolves like sponge sugar.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah.
That is not a good thing.
Yeah.
That's terrifying.
I do want to agree with what Barry said, which is that there's part of me, and we can go back to Big Little Lies here too. Mm-hmm. There's part of me that does think this is such a women's story. Mm-hmm. If you were ever going to involve more women creatively, mm-hmm. it might be nice if they popped up in a project like this. Now, with that said, I think Ryan Murphy is really, really invested in it mm-hmm. and cares deeply about it. And one thing that you see over and over is him recreating pieces of Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, mm-hmm. which I think is... I mean, it's his Be Kind, Rewind sort of, I get to make, you know, my shot for shot, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane with Susan Sarandon and Jessica Lange. And I think...
Why did nobody think of that, by the way?
Real. And I think he very much enjoys and loves doing that. And for the most part, I love projects that are made with love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I do think there's something to be said. And this appears in that MTV News piece that I referenced at the top of the segment. This does become, in Ryan Murphy's hands, a story that is largely about these women relative to this studio system mm-hmm. controlled by men. So, you know, I would say apart from the two of them, the primary character is the director, who's played by Alfred Molina.
Mm-hmm.
And you get so much of kind of, he's got to manage these two broads
yep.
and he's mm-hmm. got to keep his project on target by managing,
director, right.
by managing these two crazy broads. And there is kind of a long detour that I didn't care about very much, about him kind of going off and trying to make this movie with Frank Sinatra, and mm-hmm. that I kind of felt like he's not my concern, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that may just be because Murphy doesn't have a specific idea about him that I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But you do wind up with these women kind of being a drag for this man who is the closest thing you have to an audience surrogate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little, I felt a little weird about that, about the kind of angle at which the story was being told,
yes.
that they're really being turned into women in a story about a male-run system. Do you
and
know
they,
what I mean?
And they were, and to a certain extent, like, they are playing exactly the characters we thought they were
right.
when, with the first time someone told you that
right.
Joan Crawford and Betty Davis had a famous feud.
This series is great, great, great fun.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's saying
right.
very much
mm-hmm.
about
it's a cover
this,
band.
That you, it's a
yeah.
cover
it's
band.
It's a cover band mm-hmm. that I love.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah.
My sympathies shifted back and forth
mm-hmm.
Over the course
mm-hmm.
of this series, which is hugely important. Yep. This thing is not called Vendetta. It is called Feud. Mm-hmm. They are equal partners in this thing. Mm. And that means you have to see them both as being right and both as being wrong. And yes, it's set up in the beginning as Joan Crawford, the striver, and Betty Davis, the artist.
Mm-hmm.
But that keeps going back and forth. Yeah. And it's so, it's such a fine line to tread, but it really does make you shift.
Yeah. I will be curious to hear what all of you think. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. What do you think of Feud? And of course, pitch future seasons of Feud beyond Charles and Diana. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Let's take a moment to thank and share a message from our sponsor, the new CNN original series, Believer. Join best-selling author Reza Aslan on a spiritually curious journey into the worlds of Scientology, voodoo, and more on the premiere episode. Travel to India and meet the Aghori, Hindus that don't believe in spiritual purity or pollution. That means they aren't afraid to care for outcasts like lepers, and some even practice cannibalism. Believer premieres Sunday night at 10 on CNN.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
There are weeks where I have a difficult time picking what's making me happy, whether because I have too many choices
sure.
or too few.
Yes.
This is the one episode a year in which it is so blazingly obvious what I'm going to say.
Yes.
But it is so important that I say it anyway.
Yes.
You can finally download the Austin 100.
Yes.
My annual project in which I compile 100 free MP3s by artists performing at the South by Southwest Music Festival in mid-March. For 1 month, that is the month of March, you can go to npr.org/Austin100 and download, just click a button and download a zip file with 100 MP3s hand-selected by me. This process takes several months and beats me into a pulp
sure
every
you
year.
You did better this year, though.
I really, really tried to do better this year.
Yeah.
But it is a months-long process, and I am enormously happy with the quality of the music this year, the breadth of the choices. It's making me excited about the festival, just how much great stuff there was to choose from. I really personally guarantee that if you download this thing and listen, or I mean, you can also stream it through NPR One.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee that if you do that, you will find something that you haven't heard of before
mm-hmm.
that you really, really like.
Mm-hmm.
And my hope is you'll find a bunch of stuff you haven't heard before. The whole playlist is about 6 hours. And so all I'm asking of all you wonderful people is to go through, click that download button, and just give me 6 hours of your time.
Nice. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Two things. I'm backing up your recommendation from last week of My Brother and Me on CISO. It's great, but particularly they just released a blooper reel. That's worth it. The very last gag on the blooper reel is fantastic. The other thing is NBC's Powerless is a sitcom set in the DC Comics universe. It's about a company that is owned by Bruce Wayne that makes products that is in competition with LexCorp. I wrote about it when it premiered. I thought the pilot was a B-minus effort. I liked the cast a lot. I knew it had promise, but all of the jokes, it seemed to me, in the pilot came from the setting. And it's a sitcom, okay? That makes sense because situation comedy, some of the humor comes from the situation, but it can't be all of the humor because you have to have something about the interpersonal dynamics of the cast. And this cast is fantastic. It's Danny Pudi, it's Ron Funches, it's Alan Tudyk, who is the star of this thing, Vanessa Hudgens, Christina Kirk, and Jenny Pearson. Here's my pro tip for Powerless. Start with episode 3, called Sinking Day. That is a spotlight for the Alan Tudyk character. Also is, you know, Aquaman adjacent. So it's not a coincidence. But here, finally, they are using the setting, not relying upon it. And there's a lot of jokes in here that could be on any sitcom, any good sitcom, growing out of the characters, growing out of the relationships, and that are actually funny. So that's Powerless on NBC.
Very good.
Thank you,
Glenn Weldon. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I mean, obviously this deep dive into Hollywood glamour has really, really done the trick. But I also want to say today, the day that we are taping is Pub Day for for a book that I think I really, really love. It's by Angie Thomas. It's called The Hate U Give. We did a wonderful interview with the author last week on Weekend Edition Sunday, and I think this book is going to be huge. It's a young adult novel. I think the way it's been described as it's the Black Lives Matter YA novel. No, it certainly touches on that. It is one of the best books about teenage girls I have ever read. It should be read by everybody. It is very funny. It is heartbreaking. It is a book that I plan on ordering many of so that I can hand it out liberally to everybody I know. And if we were to do a book club, I would suggest it. It is beautifully written. Angie Thomas, this is her first novel. She's a young writer from Jackson, Mississippi. And I can't say enough about this book. I also want to say, because I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole through the whole Bette Davis, Joan Crawford particular window, I went back and I watched Mildred Pierce, Natch, because one should do that every now and then.
Sure.
But then I went back and I watched the Mildred Pierce that Kate Winslet did for HBO. Mm-hmm. It is so good. It is so beautifully done. And what the original lacks in kind of, you know, nuance and context, this one has in spades. And it's really, really fun to watch the two of them. And then, you know, why not pick up that novel? Because that guy knew how to write. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's what I'm recommending: two books, two miniseries, and a big glass of wine.
What a good recommendation. I like it, Barry. Thank you very much, Barry Hardiman. First, I just want to say thank you to everybody who followed our Oscars coverage. We were here very late and had a really nice time. We have a small batch out that we recorded at 3 in the mornings to make sure that Jessica Reedy could stay up until 6:30 in the morning cutting and publishing it. We have a lot of stuff available on the blog. So thanks to all of you who were there for that. And holy moly, that was an exciting end of an Oscars. Not to relive the whole thing again, but you should have been in a newsroom. I'm just telling you. You should have experienced that in a newsroom. It is a once-in-a-lifetime sort of entertainment event in that context. But my real recommendation for this week, as we record this just today, Netflix released the Mike Birbiglia comedy special called Thank God for Jokes. What he does in this special is, it really is a piece that is about jokes. And that sounds really hazardous, like to hear a comedian talk about the nature of jokes for an hour is a tricky thing. It doesn't sound like it would necessarily be funny in and of itself, but it is really funny. It is full itself of good jokes. But the thing that I really like about it, and this goes a little bit back to the fact that Birbiglia has this history as a storyteller kind of comedian. He is so good at structuring this piece so that it starts off, it has a frame. He explains, here's what we're going to talk about. Here's the framing story, right? And then he goes off and he tells you like a sub story. And then he brings you back to the main story and then goes into the next sub story and then back to the main story. He makes these little branches. It's almost like the best comparison I could think of was if you're in an empty room, if somebody kind of brings you into an empty room and they say, here's the room. And then they begin to bring things into the room and they bring in a chair and they bring in a table and they bring in a plant and they bring in some books. And you get a better and better sense of where you are. And all of those things in that room are going to come back from time to time. And there is one particular moment when he stacks four sort of callbacks to different segments, and they don't just read as like, I'm referring back to a thing I said before, remember that? He is in this one little thing, he says boom, 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 without being kind of gaudy in this way. It knits together all these different pieces and all of a sudden they're all shoved together. It is so interesting and I want to watch it again to just appreciate how funny it was because I was watching the whole thing being so admiring of how meticulously put together it is. If you're interested in the structure of an hour-long special, this is certainly not the only way to do it, But watch this and think about how he has put it together, and you will not be disappointed on that front at the very least. And also the jokes are really funny. And he's a very humanist comic, if you know that about him. Anyway, Mike Birbiglia, Thank God for Jokes, now on Netflix. That is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. And you can follow Barry at B Hardiman.
Now with 100% more tweets because I tweeted last week.
That's right. Barry now has 100% more tweets at B Hardiman. That's B-H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus, music director, and pal for life, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which Joan Crawford and Betty Davis and you are tapping their various feet to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.